I gave him lots of chances as well. So it was fortunate that this woman showed up when she did.
Yeah. See, Ken was beyond pissed because he said I'd looked at another guy for a couple seconds. I mean, as if. I'd never do that because he'd kill me.
Yes, I'm sure. So what can you tell me about your savior?
Why? Rosa said cautiously. Look, I don't want her getting into trouble. She told Ken to cool it and walk away, but he was going to knife her and then he pulled his gun. Buckley spread his hands in a disarming gesture.
I'm not here to get her into trouble, but the police are looking for her. I want to make sure that she knows Ken won't be pressing charges against her, because I also made that clear to him. As you also pointed out, Ken was going to hurt her.
Hell yes, he was. He said he was going to kill her. He fired 2 shots from the pistol before she knocked him out. So, why are the police looking for her then? If she didn't do anything wrong and Ken isn't pressing charges.
There is one small problem that goes outside of anything having to do with Ken. She apparently told people that she was an undercover cop. The police frown on that. I believe that's why they're looking for her, for identifying herself as a police officer.
She only said that to get that witch at the front desk off her case.
Nevertheless, I'm just telling you what I've been told. So, do you have any idea where she is? Or what her name is?
No. She never told me her name. And I didn't ask. But I think she was from around here. I mean, she knew where the women's shelter was. We drove straight there.
Do you believe she might have stayed there at some point?
Asked Buckley. I guess it's possible. I mean, why else would she know where it was?
Unless she worked there at some point,
suggested Buckley.
Or had a friend who stayed or worked there.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
What are your plans?
Asked Buckley. I'm not sure I have any right now.
What is your line of work?
Buckley asked. I used to be a receptionist, but I can do nails, and I did some personal fitness training.
Yes, you look very fit. So you did that before Ken came into your life?
I had some problems with stuff that sort of messed me up for a while, Rosa replied, averting her gaze. Ken and I met at a party. We hit it off, so...
Were they substance abuse problems?
Why do you say that? She asked, giving him an offended look.
Because that's the problem most people have that messes up their lives. But I'm not judging you. Lots of people get addicted for all sorts of reasons.
Well, I kicked it. At least, I'm pretty sure I did. He took out his wallet, counted out $1,000 and handed them across. What's this for? Rosa asked with a stunned expression.
Call it a down payment on financing your post-Ken life.
You don't have to do that.
No, I feel that I do.
She quickly put the cash in her jeans pocket. Thank you. That's really sweet of you.
You're welcome.
She gazed admiringly at him, obviously attracted by his good looks and expensive clothes and cultured and generous manner. I can't believe you're Ken's brother.
We were always very different, but if he had made better choices, he could have become what I did, or perhaps even better. He had some talents.
I wish I'd met you instead of him, she said coyly, gracing him with a smile as she toyed with a lock of her hair and leaned forward to show a flash of cleavage. Look, I'll leave you my number, in case you have any more, you know, questions. Maybe we could have a drink?
Maybe we could. Shall we head back?
He walked her to the shelter and watched as she disappeared inside after giving him a smile and a little wave.
Saw you give her that money, mister. Buckley turned to see a woman standing there. She was in her 50s and had clearly suffered a hard life. Her clothes were dirty and disheveled, and her eyes unfocused, and her body wobbly. she said. I live here, too. She pointed to the shelter. I heard you talking to that pretty Mex girl over coffee. I was having coffee, too, with my last dollar.
I see,
said Buckley.
Perhaps you can earn some money, too.
The lady looked at her falling apart shoes. I was here when Elle brought her in.
Elle?
Said Buckley. Elle Kane.
Is Elle short for something? Ellen? Eleanor?
Don't know about that.
Exactly how do you know her?
She used to be here, years ago. I come here off and on. You don't forget, Elle. Tallest woman I've ever met. And tough. She don't take shit from nobody.
What else do you know about her?
Asked Buckley. The woman eyed him funny. Saw you give her money, she said again. Buckley produced 10 $20 bills and passed them to the woman. She pocketed the money, looking warily around as though to check who might be watching, and said, She's a good person. Helped me.
Do you know anything about her background? Where she came from? What she does for a living?
The woman thought for a moment and then snapped her fingers. She does that kickboxing stuff. You know, that MM something.
MMA? Mixed martial arts?
The woman pointed at him. Yep, that's it.
Where does she fight?
There's a place on the south side of town. Old shoe factory or something like that. Went there one time to watch two gals near kill each other. Never saw Elle fight, but I bet she was good. Don't take shit off nobody, like I said. She told me she fought there.
She apparently is a very good fighter. When was the last time you saw her?
Well, when she brought in the Mex gal.
Anything else?
She's a good person, she said again.
I'm sure she is. Thank you.
Chapter 26. Buckley made some calls and finally located the old shoe factory. There was a fight scheduled the next night. He spent the day with his brother at the hospital after he'd undergone another surgery. As he stared down at his unconscious brother, Buckley had the sensation that this might be as good as it got for Ken, and that saddened him more than he thought it would. The next night, Buckley headed to the fights. The venue had an invitation-only list that he circumvented by passing the bouncer out front $100.
Go right in, sir,
was the bouncer's immediate reply as he tacked on a big smile. The place held about 200 people, who were both fired up and drunk. The fighters were two men with shaved heads and chiseled physiques, and tats that covered more of their exposed bodies than not. Buckley did not care about the fight. He made discreet inquiries among the staff and quickly focused on the man named Sam. After the fight was over, he cornered Sam in a back hall.
Elle Kane?
What about her? I'd like to know more about her than I do right now. What's it to you?
I'm a curious man. I understand she's a good fighter.
Sam shrugged.
Yeah, although she's past her prime if you're in the business and thinking about taking her on. But she's sneaky, and do not get in range of her kicks, man or woman. It don't matter. She brings a load. Any idea where she is now? Again, what's it to you?
5 $100 bills answered that question.
She lives in an old building they rehabbed into cheap units. It's not that far from here, or at least she did. Heard they just got rousted out by the new owners, so I don't know where she's hanging now. What do you know about her past?
Heard she came in from out west years back. She showed up here one day, said she could fight, and wanted in on the action. Physically, she looked like she could handle herself. But just being tall and strong don't make you a fighter. So I put her through a little test. I got her in the cage with one of my guys. He was in his 40s back then. Way past his prime. But he was still good, and he was a dude. What happened?
Sam lit up a cigarette and grinned as he blew out the smoke.
Buddy, what happened was, she knocked my tough guy out in about a minute. He woke up a half hour later wondering how a truck could have hit him inside the building. Well, after that, I told Elle if she really got serious about fighting, she could go somewhere. Had to be boxing or some unofficial stuff like we do here, because UFC don't have weight classes that heavy. But she only did it locally, when she really needed the dough. She fought recently against a real stud, an up-and-comer. Elle snookered the lady and broke her jaw with one of the hardest kicks I've personally ever seen, guy or gal. She grabbed her $1,000 and walked out of here. Haven't seen her since.
She ever tell you about herself? Her family?
As a rule, Elle didn't talk about herself. But let me give you a warning, friend. The last time she was here, she pulled a gun on me because I told her if she dressed up a little and acted a teeny-weeny bit feminine, me and her might have a good time. I mean, some dinner and drinks and wham-bam thank you, ma'am, and all. I saw the look in her eyes. She would have blown my damn head off without a second thought.
Goodness, and after you had expressed yourself so eloquently to the woman.
Exactly. Thank you for the advice. I will watch myself when I find her. If you find her. No doubt that's what I meant.
He got the address of where Kane had last lived. He drove over there to find a fence erected around the property and guarded by security who could tell him nothing of the people who had once lived there.
They're all gone now,
the guard said.
And good riddance. They were all lowlifes.
As Buckley got back into the car, his phone rang. It was the hospital. He listened carefully, thanked the person, and said he would take care of all the arrangements. He didn't start the car. Buckley stared out the windshield into the darkness as he thought about what the doctor had just told him. An undetected and now ruptured brain aneurysm. Nothing they could do. Ken was gone in under a minute. They weren't sure if it was connected to his recent beating, but they couldn't rule that out. In any case, they were very sorry. Buckley started the car and put on his seatbelt harness. So now he had to bury another brother. This was no longer a matter of putting L. Kane into the hospital. It was now a matter of putting the woman into a grave. Chapter 27. Buckley checked into an upscale hotel and ordered a late dinner from room service. He made phone calls and sent emails and texts while he ate his meal and drank his wine and thought about the details and decisions ahead of him. Ken would be cremated. There would be no religious ceremony. Such spectacle would have been wasted on both brothers. Buckley would scatter his youngest brother's ashes at the site of their father's brutal attack by the government. From human being to corpse to residence in a jar, before being sent headlong into the winds. All in the matter of the blink of an eye, really. It gave one pause, thought Buckley. Or it should. His room was immaculate and comfortable, having all the expected high-end accoutrements. Buckley had grown up with none of these things. For his parents, despite the money coming in from their disciples and assorted business dealings, insisted on living simply, and thought that any largesse spent on their children was out of bounds strictly on principle. Buckley had resented that as a child, but he had come to agree with his parents' philosophy that people needed to earn what they had. However, the living simply part was not something he had adhered to. Buckley had acquired the ability to purchase such luxuries not all that long ago. These included multiple residences, luxury cars, a yacht, and a private jet. It had been a hard slew, but he had gotten there in the end. But these were just toys at the end of the contest. Prizes, nothing more. The real thrill was in gaining the money, in acquiring the power, in beating others out for it. The rest of it left him uninterested, even depressed. He had been nearly killed 4 times, starting from the shootout at the family compound. A DEA-fired round had embedded itself in the wall an inch above his head as he lay on the floor, plus 3 other instances when he had been an adult and was forging his own path in life. And each time, he had never felt so alive as when he had been minutes or even seconds from death. He took out an envelope from the drawer and put 520s in it for the maid the next day. He made a habit of taking care of working-class people, because he related to them more than he did the folks with whom he did business. Many of these people had been delivered into the world already on third base, and thought it was their own effort that had gotten them so close to scoring. They believed themselves entitled to the best, because they had, through no effort of their own, always been given the best of everything. That made it all the sweeter when he outsmarted this elite class of what really turned out to be over-entitled simpletons far out of a league they stupidly believed they owned. He liked the power that money provided. He liked to make as much of it as possible because he wanted as much power as possible. But he had started making money because he had siblings to feed, and the only thing between them and starvation was me. It made a man careful. It made a man think before he acted, because one mistake could be fatal on any number of levels. But having thought things through, you were more willing to take a risk because it was a highly calculated one. Elle Kane, though he'd never met her, struck him as that sort of person, based on all he'd learned about the woman. Under different circumstances, he might have hired her to work for him. She seemed like a downtrodden person who had risen above all that life had thrown at her. He believed she would be interesting and resolute and capable of great things given the chance. But she would not be given the chance, if he had anything to say about it. Ken had to be avenged. If Buckley let that pass, what next? Before long, he would have no principles left. He went down to the pool area, lit a Maduro cigar, drank his wine, sat by the water, and read the responses to his previous communications. He demanded much of his associates. In return, they were well paid and he had their backs, come what may. He required absolute loyalty. But unlike many in his position, he returned that loyalty. Not necessarily because it was right or fair, but because, in the end, it was in his best interests. If you threw those who sometimes disagreed with you under the bus, then they wised up, and all you were left with was sycophants. And that was like inbreeding. It made everyone stupid and weak. He didn't care for women like Rosa, who could have handled things so differently with Ken, or not shacked up with him in the first place. It was clear from her clumsy pass at him that she would have jumped into Buckley's bed if he so desired. That showed no loyalty to Ken, and a lack of respect to Buckley. And actions resulted in consequences. He sent out an email with Rosa's photo attached to an associate he had put on standby after learning of Ken's death. The man answered, and things were quickly arranged. He went up to his room and slept deeply, with a clear conscience, but a burdened mind. He rose the next morning, had his breakfast, and tidied his room, folding the used towels, laying them neatly in the corner by the tub. He checked out of the hotel, liberally tipping people along the way and receiving smiles and thanks in return. He drove off in his rental car and used the car's Bluetooth feature to check in with his people. The results were promising. Rosa had relapsed in her drug addiction, taking an overdose with fatal results in an alleyway behind the women's shelter. The police were investigating, but it seemed clear that the matter would go no further than that. Buckley's $1,000 had been retrieved from the corpse, so no questions would arise from that. They might make inquiries into the gentleman who had been talking to Rosa yesterday in the cafe, but no one other than Rosa knew about his connection to Ken. And even if she had told someone about him, Buckley had a wall of respectability around him. And there was nothing unusual about a recovering addict overdosing. So that chapter on Rosa was now closed. He received another call 5 minutes later.
"We ran the license tag on the car,"
said the voice.
"The owner is Eloise Kane. I'm sending you her personal details to the extent we could find any. She's done some jail time, had some drug problems. Curious thing is, there's nothing on her until she was about 19 or 20. Before that, it's a black hole."
"Then dig into the black hole,"
ordered Buckley.
"And how do we find her?" "She has a credit card. We're using our resources and contacts to track both.
She used her card to stay at a Marriott after she attacked your brother. And her cell phone? She must have one. She can be tracked that way. She has no registered account. She could have stolen a phone and just uses local Wi-Fi and other free sources to enable calling and internet services, or it might be prepaid minutes or a burner phone or a hybrid thereof. There are lots of ways around that. Her credit card is registered to an address that's no longer valid. There's a Gmail address listed on the account, but she hasn't used it recently, and there's no really good way to track it. So we're keeping a hawk's eye on the credit card activity. If you have her car information, can't you hack into her satellite mapping service and pinpoint her location that way? It's an old car and doesn't have that feature. Send me the information on the Marriott. There's probably more than one in this town. And get me a picture of the woman, maybe a copy of her driver's license. On it, sir.
When Buckley received the hotel info, he drove to the Marriott and checked in. He spent the day walking around the property and talking to staff members about Elle Kane. He explained that he was her father's attorney and needed to get in touch with her about an inheritance. No one questioned his credibility after looking over his professional appearance and listening to his earnest, cultured voice. However, no one had seen a woman matching her description. Until he walked into the hotel bar that night. He sat on a stool and ordered a bourbon and soda on the rocks. The same bartender who had served Kane was now serving him. He described Kane generally and asked his questions, using his cover story. The woman nodded. Yeah, she was in here. Looked like she could use some good news.
Do you have any idea where she might have gone?
No, she didn't really say much. The woman wiped down the counter and attended to another customer, while Buckley waited patiently. When she came back over, she said, But something was weird.
What do you mean?
There was this thing on the news, on the TV right there. Buckley glanced at the TV and then looked back at her.
Go on.
The FBI was looking for a woman. They had her image up on the screen. They said her name, but I don't remember it. Anyway, they were looking into something that happened to her in Georgia in the early 2000s. Well, the gal on the TV looked like some wild animal. She really did. She was tall with these batshit eyes with long hair down to her butt.
Why is the FBI looking for her?
They didn't say.
And the connection to Ms. Kane?
She placed her elbows on the bar, leaned forward and said in a confidential tone, Inheritance, huh?
Yes.
Big money?
Yes.
Go figure. Some of that money coming my way, mister, because I could sure use it. Buckley placed $300 on the bar. I like your style, she said, as the money went into a fanny pack on her belt. I'm a bartender. We have to be observant, read body language and expressions, see if people are three sheets to the wind, you know?
Yes, I know.
Well, she was staring at the woman on the screen and looking scared as shit. She even spilt her beer. And when she got up to leave, I watched her go. She'd only had the one drink, but it was like she couldn't walk straight. Whoever the lady on the screen was, that gal knew her somehow. I'm sure of it. Chapter 28. Asheville, North Carolina was home to the Biltmore Estate. At nearly 180,000 square feet, it was the largest private residence ever constructed in America, and it was still owned by the descendants of the Vanderbilt heir who built it. It was now open to the public for tours and other events, and it brought a great many people to Asheville every year. The town also possessed a thriving arts and wine and food community. The western part of the Tar Heel State was picturesque, with the Blue Ridge Mountains providing a brilliant backdrop to the town. As Pine and Blum rode into Asheville, neither one was thinking about any of that. They had in their sights one person and one person only. As the FBI had finally told Blum after some delay, probably because it wasn't connected to an official case, the phone number that Pine had seen Wanda Atkins input to her phone was attached to a specific address in Asheville. The Bureau had now provided that information, and Pine meant to make good use of it. Dusk was coming quickly, and the streets they passed were filled with people sitting in outdoor restaurants with gas-fueled heaters providing warmth. Art galleries were ablaze with light and activity, and cars and pedestrians were making their way to a flurry of destinations. People of means seemed to be having a good time trying to figure out where to plunk down their hard-earned cash. "I've never been here," said Blum. "It looks quite lovely." "Only we're looking for the dark side right now, not the lovely," replied Pine. Following the navigation instructions, she turned right and then left and slowed the Porsche. "And that's it. Up on the right with the white siding." "How appropriate," said Blum, eyeing the sign out front as they passed by. "Desiree Atkins runs an occult shop. I didn't think she'd be baking cupcakes." "She goes by the name Dolores Venuti now," said Pine. "At least the phone is registered in that person's name. But it's Desiree. I'm almost sure of that." They had previously gotten Desiree's file photo from the Georgia DMV. The picture showed a stern-faced woman with protuberant eyes that Blum had proclaimed were downright creepy. "But that photo is really old," Pine had pointed out after seeing it for the first time. "I doubt she would have changed that much," said Blum. "People like her never do, except to get even creepier." The occult shop was in a small bungalow that one reached by going up a set of warped wooden steps. The large sign out front read in exaggerated calligraphy, "The Dark Moon Rising Occult Shop. Psychic readings, classic witchcraft products, power crystals and candles, protection scarves, large apothecary selection, and much more." "Protection scarves?" muttered Pine. "People really buy that crap?" "More than you think. There's a large occult business in Arizona, in fact. How do you know that?" "One of my friends is in the business. She's also a tarot card reader, has a psychic hotline, and does workshops for aspiring occultists. She makes far more money than I do." "Then the world is truly upside down, Carol." Pine pulled to a stop down the street. "The place looks dark." She checked her watch. "I don't see the hours posted, but she's probably closed for the day." "It doesn't look large enough for Desiree to live there, too. And I doubt this area is even zoned for residential." "You're probably right. She may very well live somewhere else. And she may not have a home landline. More and more people don't." "I guess there are ways we can find out where she lives. It's all a matter of speed and finding the point of least resistance." Blum eyed her keenly. "Why does that make me think you're about to do something not quite legal?" "Oh, Carol, you know me like a book. Wait here." Pine hopped out of the SUV and walked back down the street. She looked around and found this section of the street pretty empty. Good. She tried the shop's front door and found it locked. She looked through the door glass for evidence of an alarm system, but didn't see any. Maybe Desiree had put a protection spell on her shop in lieu of contracting with ADT, thought Pine. Pine walked around to the back of the building and sized it up. One door, two windows. Large, mature trees ringed the small park-like area that ran behind all the shops here. An old picnic table sat under the tree canopies. She tried the back door, but it was locked, as were the windows. Until Pine worked her knife through the gap on one of them and pushed the simple lock back. She slowly lifted the window, ready to run if an alarm sounded, but fortunately none did. She slipped through the opening and closed the window, after lowering herself softly to the floor. Her nostrils were instantly breached by mingled, pungent scents. She slipped a small flashlight from her pocket and manipulated the lens opening so that only a small, core beam was produced. She shone it over the walls. They were covered with shelves, which, in turn, were loaded with all sorts of things, many of them grotesque, at least to Pine. A bottle of fake shrunken heads was a real eye-grabber. At least I hope they're fake. Boxes of tarot cards were stacked haphazardly on a table, and they were on sale. A full-sized skeleton coated with dust hung from a holder in one corner. One could take it home for the sale price of $599.
Astrological charts in various sizes and colors hung in lopsided, chaotic patterns on the walls, along with prints of creatures that Pine did not recognize. There were books with titles like Witchcraft at Home and Self-Healing Tonics. Pine looked through the latter one and doubted that the FDA would have approved. The place was disheveled and unorganized, and there was junk piled around, including unopened cardboard boxes with the shipping labels still on them. She moved into the next room. It was small and looked to be the office. This space was also littered with papers and boxes. A laminated desk was wedged into one free corner with a computer on it. The computer required a password, so Pine ignored it and went through the desk drawers. She found some stationery with the store's name and address. And under a stack of junk, she also found a checkbook with the name Dolores Venuti printed on it, along with another address in Asheville. Pine certainly believed that Desiree and Dolores were one and the same, although she would have liked absolute confirmation on that. She found it when she looked at some photos taped to the wall. One was of a person who could only be Desiree. She fit the description Pine had been given, and more important, the DMV photo. She was standing in front of the occult shop and was smiling. Written in Sharpie at the bottom of the picture was the inscription, "Welcome to the neighborhood, Dolores." It was signed by various people, and the shops named under those signatures were probably part of the local retail community. She took a picture of it with her phone. Pine copied the address from the check onto a piece of paper and left the way she had come. She climbed back into the SUV and handed Blum the paper with the address. "Plug this into the GPS." "What is it?" "Hopefully it's where we'll find Desiree Atkins, aka Dolores Venuti." "What was the shop like?"
"Creepy, just like I'm sure she is."
"If she's home, what are you going to do?"
"Stop myself from strangling her, and then start asking my questions."
"And if she won't answer?"
"Then maybe I won't stop myself from strangling her."
"You can't mean that."
Pine put the SUV in gear. "Don't bet the farm on that, Carol." Chapter 29.
"Okay, I don't like the looks of this," said Blum, as they pulled down a long gravel road with thick woods on either side. A patch of fog was rolling in, and the only light was from the SUV's headlights. "This is right out of the opening scene of every slasher movie I've ever watched."
"Don't let your emotions run away with you, Carol," said Pine.
Blum glanced at her boss. "Aren't you a little nervous?"
"I think Desiree should be more worried about me than I should be about her."
"You believe she'll be there?"
"We're going to find out pretty soon." They rounded a bend. In the distance, they could see the lights coming from a small split-level rancher built of brick and siding. It had a forlorn look, as though it were lonely without any other homes around. There was a metal carport next to the house with no car under it. The light they saw coming from the front room.
"Great," said Blum. "The little house in the dark woods. I wonder if Hansel and Gretel are inside about to be eaten."
Pine pulled the SUV to a stop and killed the lights.
"Wait here." "I don't want you going up there by yourself." "I'm armed, and I'm a federal agent who is more than a little homicidal right now.
Put simply, Desiree is a munchkin and I'm an Amazon. But slide over into the driver's seat. Keep the doors locked and your phone in hand." Pine climbed out and made her way toward the house, keeping off the road and sidling along the tree line with careful strides. She then veered toward the front of the home and peered into one of the lighted windows. She saw furniture, pictures on the wall, a burgundy and blue rug on the floor, and not a person in sight. She edged around the corner and entered the backyard. She spied a small tool shed with gray siding and a shingled roof. She made her way over there and shone her light in one of the windows. It looked empty except for some tools, a wheelbarrow, and a stepladder. She tried the door, but it was locked. She slipped over to the rear of the house and walked up a flight of wooden steps that led to a deck built onto the back which held some old patio furniture. The door there was locked as well. She used her light to see inside the rear door and check for an alarm panel. Shit. There was one, and she could see that it was armed. Why have one here and not one at her business? She stepped back and looked around. Okay, that might be a way. Pine hustled to the tool shed and used her knife to force back the lock. She ducked inside and came back out a moment later with the ladder. The grade of the property dictated that the home had a high foundation in the rear, covered by a brick veneer. She stepped back up on the raised deck, set the ladder next to the back door, and climbed the ladder to the spot that all the warning labels implored should never be touched by a human foot. She gripped the edge of the gutter and did a chin-up, praying that the gutter would hold her weight. It did, and she swung her legs up onto the roof. She gripped the edge of an asphalt shingle and used that to pull herself fully on top of the roof. She walked across it to the upper-level section of the house, where two dormer windows presented her with possible entry points. Most home alarm systems did not arm upper-level windows. She was about to find out if this place broke that norm. She inserted her knife between the sash to pry back the clasp. If the window was armed, this far out in the country, she figured she'd have time to search the place, make and drink a cup of coffee, and get away long before the cops showed up. Fortunately, no alarm went off. She slipped through the window and closed it behind her. She shone her light around the bedroom she found herself in. It was meticulously neat and furnished sparingly. She checked the closet and found that all the pieces of clothing would fit someone of Desiree's age and petite stature. She inspected the bathroom situated in the hall next to the bedroom, then looked into the other bedroom on the other side of the bathroom. This space was empty, except for two boxes stacked on top of each other. She looked through them, but they just contained some old clothes and other odds and ends. It seemed clear that Desiree lived here alone. Pine walked back into the bedroom. She had never seen a place so neat and organized. The bed was made up with decorative pillows arranged just so, and military-level tight corners. She poked her head back in the closet. It looked to be one of those California closets jobs, with two tiers of hanging rods, glass-fronted cabinets, deep drawers running on smooth slides, and open shelves for all the footwear. It held stacks of sweaters so neatly arranged they could qualify as store displays, and pants and shirts and dresses and skirts on hangers that seemed to be arranged by type and style. Scarves, shoes, underwear, and socks were all scrupulously sorted and organized. In the bathroom, toiletries and other items were in perfect order. The bathtub slash shower was sparkling clean, the floors and countertops scrubbed and smelling of disinfectant. Towels were arranged in order of size and color in the linen closet. She made her way downstairs to find that it was laid out simply, but was, if it was possible, even more organized and clean than the upstairs. The wooden furniture in the main room was highly polished, the cushions plumped without a stain or smudge visible. The tracks in the rugs laid over oak hardwood floors showed they had been recently vacuumed. The knickknacks on the shelves were dusted, and the windows held not a streak of dirt. She started searching the other rooms down here. Each one she got to was model home organized. There was one door that was locked, but when she put her ear to the door, she could hear the rumbling of the air handler. Probably just the furnace room. The small powder room across from the foyer looked like one you would find in a high-end hotel, right down to the decorative tissue box holder and copper soap dispenser and framed artwork, plus a fancy toilet paper holder in the shape of a cat's long tail. The kitchen was small, but it sparkled. The travertine tile floor looked clean enough to have a picnic on without the blanket or even dishes. The counters were wiped down, the table set with a plate, cup, and cutlery in a rolled napkin. Canisters on the counters were arranged by height. The stovetop's six burners glistened with not a speck of grease on their surfaces. Pine opened some of the cabinets and drawers and found everything so organized, she felt like she truly was in a model house where everything was on display, No one actually lived there to do any damage, and thus all was perfect. The contents of the refrigerator were so carefully arranged that it made her own fridge back in Arizona look like a dumpster. But that really wasn't a high bar, Pine conceded. The thing that was bothering her was that she could understand Desiree being a neatnik, maybe even OCD. But then why was her shop so messy? Normally, a person with that condition didn't let their desire for organization stop at the front door of their home. Off the kitchen was a small laundry room. A basket on top of the dryer held scrupulously folded clothes. She glanced at the items and then looked away, but only for a moment. Then her gaze swung back to the stack of clothes. She took a pair of jeans off the top of the pile and held them up. Desiree had been described to her as being very short, under 5 feet, and her driver's license had confirmed this. Pine held the jeans against her own legs. They would have been too short for her, but they were also far longer than someone Desiree's height could have worn, even if she had on heels. And the style and narrow hip cut of the pants were for someone a lot younger than Desiree. The blood seemed to solidify in Pine's veins. No way. No way in hell. She put the pants back in the basket and left the laundry room. She raced back upstairs and made a more thorough search. She noted the pull-down attic door in the ceiling in the unused bedroom. She yanked on it, and a set of hinged stairs collapsed downward. Pine locked the steps in place and hustled up them. She shone her light around in the darkness and called out, "Hello? Is anyone up here? I'm with the FBI, hello?" There was no answer, no sound. She hit the entire space with her light and found nothing there. She climbed back down and lifted the stairs up. They receded into the attic opening and the access door banged shut behind them. Pine felt something moving across her head. She was standing underneath a ceiling vent. The heat had just come on again. The heat? She ran down the stairs and over to the locked door. She put her shoulder against it and pushed. She felt the lock start to give. She pulled a small lockpick kit from her jacket. She didn't bother picking the simple lock. She just used one of the tools to merely slide the door bolt back. She opened the door and turned on the light. As she had guessed, the home's HVAC system was located in here, with the ductwork shafted into the unfinished ceiling where it headed on to the rest of the house. She looked around the space. There were a couple of shelves off to the side, all stacked with boxes. The floor under the HVAC was cement. Had she been wrong in her assumption? But then why lock the door? She then walked behind the shelves to a small space. She stopped and stared when she noted that the floor here was not cement. It was tongue and groove wood. Was it just wood flooring laid over the cement? But why bother with that for a room like this, into which no one other than a repairman would ever really enter? In the farthest corner sat a hand truck with a large box perched on its lip. Pine moved the hand truck away, then bent down to examine the spot the box had covered. Pine felt like she had been gut punched. Recessed into the floor was a keyhole. As she looked over the area, she saw the parameters of the trap door. There was a lift handle inlaid into the floor next to the keyhole. Okay, here we go again, thought Pine. Chapter 30. Is anybody down there? Called out Pine through the wooden trap door. When she was met with silence, she stomped on the trap door. Hello? Is anyone down there? Nothing. Pine looked around and saw it. On one of the shelves' metal supports was a single key attached to a magnet. She pulled it free, knelt down, and put the key in the lock. She turned it and then grabbed the recessed handle. The door came up easily on hydraulic hinges. The space she was looking at was completely dark. Hello? She called out again. This time she heard a noise. No words, just a scuffling sound. Pine shone her light into the dark. A set of steps was revealed. Hello? My name is Atlee Pine. I'm with the FBI.
Is anyone down there? I'm here to help.
The sound she had heard could have been rats, but you didn't have a secret space to keep rats in, and they didn't wear jeans. She started down the steps, the light in one hand, her pistol in the other.
Hello? Please show yourself. I'm here to help you. Are you being held against your will? Where is the woman who lives here? Dolores Venuti.
Now, Pine could hear heavy breathing and whimpering, as though whoever was down here was terrified beyond belief. For a moment, she thought it might be Desiree. But this couldn't be a hiding place for the woman. She had looked at the underside of the trapdoor. The key only worked from the outside.
I'm not going to hurt you. I'm here to help you.
She reached the bottom of the space and had to bend low because the height of the rest of the room was only around 4 feet. This had to be the rear of the house, where the grade dictated the high foundation. She decided to squat on her haunches and illuminate the area with her light. She shivered because it was chilly down here. The space obviously wasn't climate controlled, and she figured the outside was right on the other side of the wall. She pointed her light to the left and slowly went to the right. She saw, with growing horror, the elements of someone living down here. Plywood and cinder block shelves with clothes piled on them. A torn beanbag chair with a pair of worn lime green Converse sneakers lying on top. A battery-powered lantern. A stack of magazines. A mattress with covers and a single pillow strewn haphazardly over it. Then Pine tensed when she saw the sock-clad foot. She slowly lifted the flashlight, and the beam traveled upward, along the legs clothed in jeans, past the waist, rode up the baggy sweatshirt, and finally came to rest on the young, terrified face staring back at her, the eyes squinting as the beam drilled into them. Pine lowered the light and said,
I'm with the FBI. I'm here to help you.
She looked around at what was obviously a prison.
Get out of here.
The girl balled herself up tighter and shrank deeper into the corner in which she was cowering. She had a blanket half wrapped around her because of the chill. As Pine raised the light beam to show the girl's face, it shook back and forth as though answering Pine's statement with disbelief and also a refusal of the offered help. Pine put her gun back into its holster and took out her badge. She turned the light on herself so the girl could see both Pine's face and the shiny FBI shield.
I'm with the FBI. Do you know what that is? I'm a federal cop.
Pine turned the light on the girl once more to see her reaction. She looked even more terrified, if that was possible. Pine slid over, snagged the lantern, and turned it on. The light feebly illuminated the space, but it was strong enough that Pine could put her flashlight away. She sat cross-legged on the floor across from the girl and studied her. To Pine, she looked to be around 13 or 14, with gangly arms and legs, about 5'5". Her skin was as pale as milk, her build scrawny. There were bruises on her face and a cut on her lip. Her hair was blonde, stringy, and dirty looking. The eyes were of someone who distrusted everyone and everything.
Can you tell me your name?
The girl hugged herself and shriveled back. Pine said quietly,
I can get you out of here. Do you want to be free?
The girl shook her head and finally spoke.
No. Why not? You can't possibly want to stay here. She'll be mad.
Who?
Dolores?
The girl nodded. You let me worry about Dolores. We can leave right now. I can take you to a safe, warm place. Pine reached out a hand, but the girl shrank back.
No, the dog, it'll bite me.
What dog? The girl pointed upward. I've been through the whole house. There is no dog.
Outside,
said the girl, her eyes widening. I came from the outside. I saw no dog. Do I look like I've been attacked by a dog? The girl ran her gaze over Pine,
and for the first time looked more confused than scared. Dolores told you there was a dog? The girl nodded. What's your name?
I'm Atlee.
I'm Gail. Okay, Gail.
I saw no dog.
Dolores lied to you.
Gail sat up straighter and wrapped the blanket around her lower legs.
But I hear it barking when I'm down here.
Pine thought about this for a few moments. Does she let you out of here?
Only when she's here. I do the cleaning and cooking and stuff.
I thought you might. But did you ever feed the dog? I mean, I saw no dog bowls or dog toys. And if it's kept outside, there was no dog house or a chain.
No, I never fed the dog. I'm scared of them.
When the dog barks, does it always sound the same?
Gail shrugged.
I guess. I mean, it was a dog barking, and I heard it like an hour ago.
Tell me something. Does it always happen at the same time when Dolores isn't here, and you're down here?
Gail thought about it.
Maybe, yeah.
Right. Well, there's technology that allows someone to do that, with a recording set on a timer.
There's really no dog?
No. Have you ever left the house?
Not since I came here. Dolores said I couldn't. It wouldn't be safe.
Why wouldn't it be safe?
Gail said.
I stole some food and other things from a store, and the police are after me.
Who told you the police were after you? Dolores?
Yes.
After you told her you stole the things?
Yeah. She asked me a bunch of questions, and I told her about it.
How did you come to even be here?
I was hitchhiking, and Dolores stopped and picked me up.
When was this? How long have you been here?
Gail shrugged again.
I'm not sure. Maybe 6 months. Maybe longer.
Where's your family?
Don't have any. My mom and dad died. Overdosed.
I'm sorry. Didn't you have any other family who could take you in?
No. So they put me in foster homes. That didn't work out too well. So I ran away.
Then Dolores brought you here. And made you live down here?
Not at first. I slept upstairs on the couch. But then she said I had done some bad things. I didn't know what they were, but she kept on and on about them. I work really hard for her. I keep the house spotless, and I cook and do the laundry. I do what she tells me to do. But then she said I had to come down here and sleep. But she said if I did better, I could move back upstairs where it's warm.
Why does she even have a space like this?
She said it was like a safe room. She had it put in when someone broke into her house once. At least that's what she said.
Okay, said Pine. But the door only locks from the outside. So it's not much of a safe room, is it? Gail looked confused.
Oh, right. I never thought about that.
Does anyone ever come by here?
Not that I know of. I've never seen anybody except Dolores.
So you've never tried to get away?
I wouldn't have anywhere to go. And I thought there was a dog.
She burrowed her face into her knees and started to sob. Pine slid over and put her arm around her. At first, Gail jerked back, but then she slowly leaned into Pine's shoulder.
Okay, look. First thing, we need to get you out of here. I have a friend waiting in a car outside. We'll take you to where we're staying and get you cleaned up and buy you a meal, okay? You look hungry.
Dolores said I'm so skinny I don't need to eat much.
Yeah, I'm sure she did. Put your sneakers on and grab whatever else you want to bring with you. There's nothing, really.
Okay, let's go. Pine led the girl up the steps and out of the room. They had reached the foyer when the two women stepped out from the shadows. Pine saw Blum burst and Desiree second. The little woman was holding a gun to the side of Blum's head. She had put on weight, and her hair was long and gray and clung to her head like strings of weighted beads. The face was hard and tight and full of venom. She looked at Pine and said, "You're not going anywhere." Chapter 31.
"I'm sorry, Agent Pine," Blum said, even as Desiree Atkins dug the muzzle deeper into the woman's temple. "She was on me before I knew it."
"Shut up," said Atkins, before she glared at Gale. "What the hell are you doing up here? Do you want the dog to get you?" she added shrilly.
Gale shrank back behind Pine. Now Atkins leveled her gaze on Pine, her brow wrinkled.
"You look really familiar to me. Do I know you? You look like trouble."
Pine said, "I probably look like a lot of people who you think are trouble." Atkins nodded, but her suspicious look was still present on her features.
"I have a surveillance camera set up at the end of my driveway. I got an alert and saw on my phone when you drove in. Joe taught me all about surveillance, but the stuff they have nowadays, all wireless with a phone app, it's how I disarmed my alarm system before coming in just now."
Pine just stared at the gun.
"Wanda told me you were snooping around."
Pine said nothing. She just kept her eyes on the pistol held against Blum's head.
"Wanda said you were looking for Becky."
Now Pine spoke. "Her name is Mercy, not Becky. That was the name you gave her."
"Well, whatever. She was Becky to me."
She glanced at Pine's waist.
"You're FBI, so you got a gun. Take it out and put it on the floor. Real, real slow. I know how to use this gun real good."
Pine took out her Glock and, holding it by the muzzle, knelt and set it on the floor. Pine had a Beretta Nano in an ankle holster as her backup weapon, but it was useless so long as Atkins had the gun against Blum's head. Atkins smiled in triumph as Pine stood.
"Now, that's real good. No trouble from you, I can see. Becky was a badass, a real troublemaker. You not so much."
Pine just stood there looking at Atkins. The woman said,
"Now, you two are gonna get in Gale's little hidey hole."
"And then what?" asked Pine.
"And then I'm leaving. I'm all packed to go, suitcase in the car. I was as soon as Wanda called me.
And Gale?
She'll be coming with me. She needs me to take care of her. Don't you, Gale?"
Gale looked up at Pine with baleful eyes. "You don't have to go with her, Gale," said Pine.
"Hey, hey!" cried out Atkins. "You don't tell her shit like that. You do that again, your friend here gets it good."
She shoved the muzzle so hard into Blum's face that the woman moaned.
"Okay," said Pine. "Okay."
"That's better," said Atkins, clearly enjoying this. "Now move."
Pine led the way with Atkins bringing up the rear, her gun still pointed at Blum's head. They entered the HVAC room where the underground space was.
"Okay, you can hold up right there," said Atkins.
She shoved Blum toward Pine. The woman staggered and nearly fell, but Pine was quick enough to catch her. Now Atkins pointed her gun at Pine as her finger slid to the trigger.
"I take it we're going down into that space feet first," said Pine.
"Well, I can't very well let you live to tell people things. I guess somebody will find you eventually. By then, I'll be in another country."
"It'll be tough to get out of the country with Gale."
"Who said she was coming?"
Atkins said brusquely.
"So you're gonna kill her too?" said Pine.
"Gale is a little scared mouse. She'll do what I tell her to do and..."
The next instant, Atkins cried out, because Gale had jumped forward and bitten down on the hand holding the gun. She scratched and clawed at the woman's eyes.
They struggled until Atkins brought the gun down on Gail's head, and the girl gasped and fell away. Then a far stronger hand gripped Atkins's gun. She looked up into the face of Pine. Pine couldn't help but smile as she cocked her arm back and then slammed her bony fist into the woman's face. The massive blow flung the much smaller woman against the wall, where Atkins slumped to the floor unconscious. When Atkins woke up about 10 minutes later, she moaned and slowly sat up. Her eye was blackened and swollen shut, and her right cheek was heavily bruised. She looked up with her good eye at Pine, who towered over her.
"Get up," said Pine.
I don't think I can.
Pine gripped her under the arm and jerked Atkins to her feet. She pulled the woman over to the box on the hand truck and pushed her down on it. Gail cowered in a corner, holding a washcloth filled with ice against her injured head. Blum stood next to Pine. Pine said, "Your little mouse turned into a lioness, Desiree. I saw a little girl do that after being kidnapped by a creep in Colorado. He never thought she would do what she did, because she was young and a girl. He's currently in a state pen for the rest of his life." Atkins glared at Gail and rubbed her swollen cheek.
Need a doctor.
You're going to need a lot of things, including a lawyer. But even that won't be good enough to save your ass.
You broke into my home, and I was defending myself.
And Gail?
I have no idea who she is. Was she hiding in here? I never come into this room.
Pine gave Atkins a condescending look. 3 witnesses against you, Desiree. And the fact that you have a hidey hole where Gail was forced to live. And then there's the little matter of what happened back in Georgia.
What happened back in Georgia was that bitch Becky killed my husband,
Atkins barked furiously. Spit flew out of her mouth along with the words.
Now there's the real Desiree Atkins.
I knew you were just hiding the psychopath in there somewhere. Pine leaned against the wall. Why don't you tell me what happened that night?
Why don't you go to hell?
Blum stepped forward. You're going to prison. The only question is for how long. If you cooperate, it won't be as long as it otherwise would be. When Atkins didn't answer, Pine pulled out her phone. Okay, let's just get the cops in here. They'll charge you with kidnapping, unlawful imprisonment, and attempted murder, among other felonies. And then we'll call the Georgia police. They've been looking for you for a long time, Desiree. You fled a murder scene. There's no statute of limitations on murder. And you imprisoned Mercy. We have video proof, and Wanda will testify as well. You've got no chance. Pine started to punch in the number.
Wait!
Exclaimed Atkins. Pine looked at the woman while her finger hovered over the phone. I'm listening.
What do you want to know?
We know Mercy broke out of her prison. Then what?
She attacked us. She knifed Joe and went after me. But I got away.
Where'd she get the knife?
She had it with her.
Pine held up her phone. If you keep lying, I will call the police and it's all over.
I'm not lying.
Mercy had no knife. We saw the tape. Atkins knitted her brows.
She must have found one on the way to the house.
Yeah, I'm sure you leave butcher knives lying all over the ground. Who fired the shot?
What shot?
Pine held up her phone again, but said nothing.
That was Joe. Becky jumped him and he shot at her but missed.
You don't miss with a shotgun, not at close range. Atkins looked panicked, glancing this way and that. Let me tell you what I think happened, said Pine. Mercy was running toward the road, because that was her escape route. But before she could do that, she ran into you and Joe. There was a confrontation. Joe and Mercy went at it. She hit him in the head and fled. Somehow, a shot was fired. Then something happened, and Joe ended up dead from a knife in his back. Then you got your stuff together and called the Atkinses.
Wanda met you at the Esso station, drove you to Atlanta, and put you on a bus, and you got the hell out of Dodge. You ended up here and got yourself another slave, because that's just the sort of sick person you are.
You have no proof of anything that happened in Georgia.
Pine shook her head. You're going to prison. It's long overdue.
What if I told you your precious Mercy was killed that night?
Sneered Atkins. You can tell me, but that doesn't make it true. The fact is, if she was dead, you'd have had no reason to kill Joe. And if you hadn't killed him, you'd have had no reason to run, would you? Because the cops didn't know you were holding a young woman prisoner. You'd just bury her in the woods, and that would be that. Defeated, Atkins looked away and said nothing. Pine stared at her for a long moment, disgust dripping from her features. Then she called the police. Chapter 32.
We've contacted Gail's family, Agent Pine,
said Deputy Sheriff Tate Callum. Pine and Blum were at the Buncombe County Sheriff's Office in Asheville. The battered Atkins was just down the street at the county detention center after having been arrested and formally charged. Callum was in his late 30s, trim with a brisk manner and blue eyes topped by close-cropped blonde hair. He was heading up the North Carolina piece of Desiree Atkins's crime spree. She told me that her parents overdosed and were dead. Callum nodded thoughtfully.
That's true, but we found an aunt and uncle. Apparently they were in no financial condition to take Gail in when her parents died. Now they are, and they want her to come live with them. They're coming here to get her, in fact.
That's wonderful news, said Blum. What about Desiree Atkins? Asked Pine. Or Dolores Venuti, as she's known around here. Pine had filled in Callum on Atkins's true identity and her being sought on suspicion of murder in Georgia.
Fact is, once she gets a lawyer and he sees what the evidence against her is, she'll probably do a deal. But there's more. My deputies are at her shop right now, and they've been reporting in what they've found. Kidnapping and imprisoning Gail is bad enough, but they've found evidence of what looks to be a drug distribution operation in a secret room at her shop. I guess the occult business wasn't making enough money. She's looking at a minimum of 20 to life when all is said and done, and that doesn't take into account the Georgia piece you told me about. I plan on calling the Georgia folks tomorrow.
Can we see Gail now?
Sure thing. If you hadn't come along, I'm not sure what would have happened to her. I know she's been through a lot, but she's showing some real pluck.
Callum led them to a small office where Gail was seated and eating a sandwich and a bag of chips and drinking from a bottle of water. There was a bandage on her head from where Atkins had struck her with the gun. Callum left them and Pine and Blum took seats opposite the girl.
How's your head? Asked Blum.
It's fine. She smiled weakly and rubbed the spot. Dolores has hit me lots harder than that.
We heard about your aunt and uncle. That's really good news, said Pine.
Yeah, I guess.
Did you have a good relationship with them?
They didn't live that close to us. I suppose that's why I went into foster care. But they have a daughter my age, Sarah. We used to get together way back.
Pine said, It was very brave what you did. You saved our lives. Gail put her sandwich down and took a drink of the water.
I couldn't believe she was just going to abandon me like that. It made me so mad, after all I'd done for her.
Pine and Blum exchanged a nervous glance. Blum said, She's not a good person, Gail. You're far better off without her. Just put her out of your mind. She's not worth thinking about anymore. She's really not. Pine added, You can see that, right? Gail looked up at her.
I just don't want to be left alone again. It's scary.
You won't be. But after what happened to you, you're going to need some counseling.
Counseling?
Gail looked terrified. Just someone who's trained to help people through some bad events in their lives. The person will just talk to you, Gale. And you can talk to them about things. It's only meant to help you put this awful experience behind you and get on with your life in a positive way.
Oh, okay.
She munched on her sandwich, but still looked wary of the whole thing. And like you said, you have a cousin your age. You can grow up like sisters. It'll be fun. Always someone to talk to and share stuff with. Gale looked intrigued by this possibility.
I never thought about having a sister. Do you have a sister?
Pine said slowly. Yes, I do. A twin sister, in fact. It's pretty cool. She is my best friend. Gale smiled.
That's pretty dope. A twin? Are you identical?
I think you could probably tell us apart now.
Okay.
Pine handed her a card. This is my contact information. Anytime you want to, please give me a call. I mean it, okay? They exchanged hugs with the girl and left her there. Do you think she's going to be all right? Asked Blum. Right this minute, there's no way to tell. She was with Desiree only 6 months, so maybe the damage won't be permanent. She's been through a lot for someone so young. She probably just needs time to heal. As they walked down the corridor, Blum said, Are you okay? I will be okay, if I ever find my sister. And if we don't find Mercy. I'm not going to think about that possibility right now. What do we do next? We need to talk to Desiree again. Hopefully for the last time. Chapter 33. The detention facility was clean, sleek, and modern-looking, but it still had bars and secure doors to keep the bad people away from the good. Pine had learned there were more than 500 prisoners kept here in the main facility and in a jail annex. She was only interested in one. Callum had called ahead, and they were quickly led to Desiree Atkins's cell by one of the guards. As the door opened and then clanged shut behind them, Atkins never once looked up. She was sitting in the one chair in the room that was bolted to the floor and was dressed in prison duds. She was staring at her hands like they contained all of her problems and none of the solutions. She had a bandage taped over her cheek, and the skin around her eye was now yellow and purple. Pine leaned against the upper bunk while Blum stood near the door. The jailer had moved away to give them as much privacy as one could expect in a place such as this. What the hell do you two want? Asked Atkins, glancing up. Come to gloat?
We came for a chat, replied Pine.
Go screw yourself, and I'm suing your ass for assault. I might have brain trauma.
Yeah, you definitely have something off in your head, but it had nothing to do with me. And you have the time to talk, since you won't be leaving here anytime soon. No bail because you're a flight risk, said Pine. And they know all about Georgia.
Atkins's eyes glittered with hatred. Good, and I can tell them how Becky killed my husband. They need to put her in prison for murder.
You can try, but your imprisoning her for all those years will mean whatever you say will not pass the smell test, said Pine. Even if she killed Joe, she had every right to. He was just going to lock her up again. Enslaved people have an absolute right to do whatever it takes to get free. We actually fought a civil war over that.
What do you care about, Becky? It's been what? Almost 20 years? Give it a rest.
Pine curled her long fingers around the bunk support post, primarily so she couldn't form a fist with them and have another go at the woman. Blum noted this, stepped forward and said,
Why did you do it, Desiree? Why did you treat Mercy the way you did?
Atkins snarled.
What exactly did I do? I'll tell you. I took the kid in when no one else wanted her. This guy plopped her in Wanda's lap, like she could take care of a 6-year-old,
Give me a break. She smoked so many packs of cigarettes a day she got winded going for the mail. The kid would have died but for me. I should be getting a medal, not a prison sentence.
Pine said, You abused her. You tortured her. You locked her in a hole in the wall in the woods. You call that doing her a favor?
Atkins turned pink with indignation.
She was wild. She was uncontrollable. We had to lock her up. If you had only seen her back then.
So she wouldn't escape, you mean?
I don't have to tell you anything else.
But if you do, I can put in a good word for you.
Right. Shave 2 years off whatever I'm going to get. No thanks.
Did she ever mention her family? Persisted Pine. Did she ever tell you what happened to her? What her real name was? Did you ever even ask?
Atkins waved all this off.
I had my own problems.
You can tell us nothing.
I can tell you plenty. I choose not to. That's my right. And there's not a damn thing you can do about it, bitch.
Wanda told us you tried, but could never have kids of your own, said Blum.
Atkins shot her a cruel look.
What's your role here, Granny? To be the good cop? Guilt me into saying something? Don't waste your time, hag.
I mean, you must have wanted children. You took Mercy in, like you said, Blum added, while Pine watched her with a curious expression.
Damn right. I took her in when nobody else would, like I said. I did her a favor. And what did I get out of it? Heartache and misery.
So you did care for her at some point?
Atkins calmed a bit, and the vindictive look in her eyes faded somewhat.
I took care of her. I dressed her and fed her. She was clean. Until we moved her where we did.
Blum sat down on the bunk opposite Atkins and said in a quiet voice,
Because she was unruly.
Because you were fearful of what she might do.
That's understandable.
Pine shot Blum a look but remained quiet.
Yes! She terrorized us. By the time she was 11, she was taller than Joe. When Becky hit 13, she grew like a weed. She was huge. At 15, she was over 6 feet and strong as a horse. Joe always took the gun when we went out to the woods. I insisted on that. And when he was gone during the day, I had to keep the gun on her while she was doing work for us. It got so we had to make her do most of her chores after Joe got home, because I was scared to be around her alone, even with the gun. If we'd let her stay in the house, she would have killed us in our sleep. It was like having a wild animal around. Even when she was out in the woods, I barely got any rest. I was a nervous wreck all the time.
Pine inwardly seethed at these callous remarks. As though Atkins's misery had been greater than her sister's. As though Mercy was at fault somehow. But she said nothing. Blum was obviously working on something, and Pine wanted to let it play out.
And she probably kept secrets from you, said Blum. People like that often do.
She did, said a now animated Atkins. Exactly. Joe said she didn't, but what did he know? He tried to trust her when she was still little. She just suckered him.
Blum said, Men are clueless about reading women. We both know that. When you get to a certain age like we both are, it becomes very clear.
Atkins pointed at Blum and grinned.
You hit it right on the head, men. They're moronic when it comes to women. They don't know how we think. The head games we play. The manipulation we use,
she said in a little girl voice.
Oh, big, strong man, you're so much smarter than me. Can you come over here and do everything I tell you to do?
She grimaced.
And see where that got Joe? An early grave.
But you weren't fooled, said Blum.
Atkins shook her head and tacked on a cackle.
I saw right through her. I knew what she was about. She didn't fool me for 1 minute. All this innocent crap, trying to get Joe on her side. It was disgusting.